Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of May. First hour of the program today, we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court and the leaving of the court on the part of Justice David Souter. He is a man who is known for his eccentricities. The New York Times wrote this week, his daily lunch of yogurt and an apple, core and all. And as a result of some of his eccentricities, he was thought of as a loner. But they say his polite but persistent questioning of lawyers who appear before the court displayed his meticulous preparation and his mastery of the case at hand and the cases relevant to it. Far from being out of touch with the modern world, he has simply refused to surrender to it control over aspects of his own life that give him deep contentment: hiking, sailing, time with old friends, and reading history. We'll be talking about his contribution to the court this hour of the program, and we will also be looking ahead at where President Barack Obama will be going in terms of naming somebody to the Supreme Court. We'll have two guests with us this hour. Peter Rofus is with us. Professor Rofus is a professor of law, associate dean for academic affairs, and director of part-time legal education at Marquette University. And he has this interesting part of his background. While at Marquette, he has also served as an advisor to Senator Herb Kohl and the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. Senate on the nominations of David Souter, Clarence Thomas, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, and John Roberts to the Supreme Court. And he has also been a member of a statewide commission appointed by Wisconsin's U.S. senators to evaluate and recommend candidates for federal judicial vacancies. Later, we will have a professor from Northwestern University School of Law with us, and we'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation today. Peter Rofus, Professor Rofus, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Good morning.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. You know, I've always wondered, why eat the core of an apple? I don't know if I'll ever get the answer to that question. He ate the whole apple. That's a little bit eccentric, huh?
You won't get the answer to that from me.
No, I probably won't. What about, people have said about him that there just won't be any more David Souters, that we heard that cry, no more suitors, frequently coming from Republicans because they were upset about the way he turned out. But there was something deliberate about the way he did everything. There was something genuine about him, that he was admired by a number of people, wasn't he?
Well, he deserves to be admired by many, those who know his work and those who don't. In his 19 years on the nation's highest court, he probably contributed as much or more than any other justice in that time to the values that we want from our judicial system.
And in what ways? How did he make that significant a contribution?
He cared deeply about the law. This was a person who was steeped in law. For all the jokes about eccentricities, put that aside, this is someone who cared deeply about a host of elements of law, about what the law was before he got there, the respect for precedent and stare decisis, how his decisions would affect everyday human beings, how his decisions would affect the legitimacy of the court in the eyes of those who viewed it and assessed it. He cared deeply about matters of institutional integrity, about his colleagues. He avoided the ad hominem attacks that are becoming more prevalent in Supreme Court decisions. He was someone that there may not be any more David Souters in the way you mean, but I think David Souter was someone that if you or I or many other people had a case to be evaluated, we'd want the David Souter on that bench.
Oh, that's interesting. The Times article said that he had a continued dismay at the court's 5-4 ruling 2 years ago invalidating the effort by the public schools of Louisville to prevent resegregation. And then last week during the court's final argument, the question whether a central portion of the Voting Rights Act is constitutional, and it looks as though the answer will be a no to this. Someone has said that I got the sense he was disappointed that he might be leaving the court with a dissent in this case as being his parting gesture. What do you think?
Sure. I saw the same words that you're quoting. But again, his career won't be evaluated. His contributions won't be measured in terms of the final voting rights case. Yeah, affirmative action has been a constant issue in the 19 years that he's been before the court. And for the most part, he has put his he's put his marbles with the slice of the court that views affirmative action programs a bit more favorably, if you will, than the other slice of the court.
I know that you were serving as an advisor to Senator Herb Kohl back at the time when he was selected by the court. Was it a choice that everybody said, who the heck is he?
Not at all. Indeed, Kathleen, I spent Labor Day. One of my colleagues shot me a note the other day saying, I've now come full circle. I've worked on the nomination of a justice to the Supreme Court who is now retiring, and therefore it's time for me to go as well. I spent Labor Day weekend of 1990, 19 years ago, looking at pretty much everything that David Souter had written and pretty much everything that had been written about him while he was Attorney General of New Hampshire, while he sat on the highest court of New Hampshire, and the rest of his life. And the conclusion I came to, candidly, was that he would turn out to be a justice who had significant respect for precedent. Remember, this was the aftermath of Robert Bork's 1987 rejection. There was a host of talk back then about paper trails and not wanting justices, candidates with substantial paper trails. The truth of the matter is, the individuals and interest groups who opposed David Souter, the Ted Kennedys, and other groups that we consider on the left of the political spectrum, in many respects, owe a great deal to David Souter, the New Hampshire Yankee Republican. A lot of people got it wrong, but not because the evidence wasn't there that David Souter would turn out to be the justice that he was. I think not because there was evidence there to indicate he would turn out to be very much like what he has turned out to be.
Mm-hmm. What about his remarks concerning history, that he felt it very, very important to do a lot of reading, and he is very fond of reading history books and will go home and do a great deal of that? Did history inform him on the bench? Should it inform a Supreme Court justice?
Well, of course it should inform a Supreme Court justice. Part of interpreting the Constitution, part of understanding federal statutes, part of doing the work of the court is understanding the past. And Souter did understand the past, and in some important areas of the constitutional law, he took on colleagues, Chief Justice Rehnquist, for instance, with regard to the history of the religion clauses. He took on colleagues about the historical accuracy of their portrayals of the past. He cared deeply about constitutional history and the way past events, the formation of the Constitution, etc., formed Constitution and ought to play a role in how we interpret the Constitution. We all have hobbies, and the fact that he liked to read and read history makes him, I think, not particularly different from an awful lot of people who have sat on our nation's highest courts and sit in many other places, in the White House, in Congress, and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. What about, so much has been made about his conservative credentials, surprising his conservative patrons with generally what have been described as liberal votes. In other words, you know, thus the cry, no more David Souters. He didn't turn out to be the guy we had hoped he was going to be.
I've said this on your show a couple of times before, Kathleen. I think discussions of Supreme Court justices would benefit dramatically if we could avoid using two words you used in that sentence, a conservative
and a liberal.
and liberal. As I said earlier, the fact that he may have disappointed people, I think is, first of all, I think the quality of his work product will stand against any justice with whom he shared the 19 years. If you look at any institution, and the people in it, as does this person make the institution stronger on the one hand or less strong on the other? No doubt that unless one is an ideologue and sees the court only as an extension of politics. David Souter made our nation's highest court stronger and made the jurisprudence coming out of that court more respectable, more legitimate. The fact that in so doing, he may have, on the one hand, disappointed some who wanted to be an wanted him to be an ideologue, and surprised others who vigorously, like Ted Kennedy, opposed his nomination, and must be embarrassed historically for those reasons. That says much more about them, I think, than it does about David Souter. There was nothing in the history of David Souter in 1990 to suspect that he would be an ideologue of the sort that some would like to have on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And the president that appointed him, we sometimes forget, was what is sometimes called a country club Republican, not the Republican that his son was. And so for all this talk, I doubt very much that the president who appointed him was disappointed in Justice Souter.
A lot has been written about the fact that the court now, a lot of the people, they're not the same, but they haven't had elective office. All but one went to school at Harvard or Yale. Many of them have not worked in private practice, that Souter had a more varied background. Would you say that that's true? And it would it serve the new president well to put somebody on the bench who has a more varied background, or pick him from some, him or her from some other area, like the governor or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, let's start with sort of the second part of that question. I don't think you'd want, say the folks, many of the folks listening to this show would want to appoint as the coach of the Green Bay Packers someone who'd never watched a football game, someone who'd knew nothing about football, never played, never watched, didn't understand offense or defense. And so when I hear folks say what I said several decades ago, wow, wouldn't it be cool to have on the nation's highest court someone who wasn't a lawyer, for instance, wasn't educated as a lawyer? That's interesting, but a lot of what the justices do is hard, unexciting, legal work, if you will. The hard work of judging requires certain amount of skill in the law and legal principles. So that part of your question, I think it would be, there may be a handful of human beings in this country who could make a substantial contribution to the court without being trained as lawyers. But I think those would be hard to find. Now, on the other hand, we do have a court stocked with former appellate judges, particularly former federal appellate judges. Souter's background was a little bit more varied. He spent a couple years in private practice, did not enjoy it, was an assistant attorney general and then attorney general of New Hampshire, was appointed to New Hampshire's highest court, so he knew state court and the impact that state judges have on human beings. I think it is good to have judges on the highest court who are diverse. Sandra Day O'Connor and many others talked about what Thurgood Marshall, the nation's first African-American justice, brought to the bench. That would be a good thing. But ultimately, one needs to have people who are outstanding, who are really good at what they do. A diverse background is wonderful, but if the person cannot do well the work of the nation's highest court, That person hasn't isn't really fulfilling an important goal. So I admire and I share the view that having people with diverse backgrounds on the highest court, particularly folks who may not necessarily have sat on the federal appellate bench, can be a very good thing and is a very good thing. I'm not so convinced any longer that taking a person off the street and putting them on the nation's highest court is a particularly good idea.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us this first half hour of the program, Professor Peter Rofus, Professor of Law, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Director of Part-Time Legal Education at Marquette University. Bill from Neillsville is our first caller. Hi, Bill.
Well, good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, the Supreme Court choice, I think, is a critical matter in the United States here, because what we've seen is, two very different philosophies being represented on the Supreme Court, and my preference is the conservative view. But President Obama made a comment about the next Supreme Court judge nomination would have to be able to empathize with the people. Now, I'll tell you what I think he means by that, and then you tell me what you think he meant. Now, I believe that when he speaks of has to empathize, I believe that he means that they'll have to empathize with the leftist view, probably expanding abortion choices, expanding gay rights, restricting free speech by calling it hate speech, probably somebody who is favorable to the fairness doctrine. And so I think that that's what he means, which would mean that this would be a liberal judge. And my understanding of the Constitution is that it's not the duty of the Supreme Court justices to interpret the law, but rather to apply the law. And so that is what I would like to see, as somebody who takes a very narrow view of the Constitution and applies it as it was written.
Professor Rufus.
There's a lot in the caller's call, and I don't know if we have time to unpack it all, so let's unpack the most important things. First, the caller started by saying that there are two principal philosophies on the court. I don't share that view. I think there's actually a multiplicity of philosophies on the court that cannot be captured with the words conservative, for instance, which is the philosophy that the caller identified with. And let the caller determine for himself if, say, the result in Bush against Gore is consistent with his conservative philosophy. As to President Obama's comment about empathy, I actually think it's quite simple. I think what he's saying is something that any president would say, and that any president would agree with, that he'd like to have his nominees to the highest court understand that what they do often, not always, but often, has influence, affects the day-to-day lives of human beings. And he wants his nominees to be able to understand that and to put themselves in the position of people who will be affected by his or her decisions. And I think that's kind of like arguing about apple pie. I think virtually all of us think it's a good thing, and virtually all presidents of any stripe, ideologically or political party-ish, would want their nominees to possess empathy in the way that I think President Obama means it. And finally, I suspect President Obama is going to surprise, as he has surprised this candidate, Obama. As a professor, he did not wield the sort of leftist tools that the caller suggests. I think you're going to find his nominees overall to be committed to certain values that President Obama is committed to, confirmable, and folks who are of very high quality and may surprise themselves, as David Souter did, in not being the leftist that the caller thinks that the first or second or third nominee will be.
More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll talk about women and heart health to heart attack survivors. Will be joining me. I'm also a heart attack survivor, and a cardiologist will talk to us about women and heart disease. Back to phone calls now for Professor Peter Rufus. Jim from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for reminding us about that heart issue, because I've got another person to add to my prayer list, namely you, of course.
Oh, thank you.
The thing I wanted to call about with the selection of the Supreme Court justice is that, it's just to look at the trend you know, in the past, Bill Maher has been ripping on previous administration, saying that they had the theme of no dollars left behind, and that if you give a person a gun, he can rob a bank, but if you give a person a bank, he can rob everyone. And yesterday in the Milwaukee Journal, Orrin Hatch was quoted on the issue of selection of the Supreme Court justice, and he said, we all know he's going to pick a more liberal justice. The question is, are they qualified? Are they going to be people who are going to be fair to the rich, the poor, the weak, the strong, the sick, and the disabled? What was interesting to me, of course, is that the first word that came out of his mouth and who they're going to be fair to was the rich, which is a Republican-based constituency. And, you know, I think it's long overdue that we had some justices that are thinking about the rest of us.
Professor Rofus.
Well, I was struck, too, by Senator Hatch's comment, because he used a comparative phrase, the nominee will be more liberal, but he didn't finish the comparison. In other words, it wasn't clear more liberal than what, than whom. But again, I think most of us, virtually all of us, share the caller's view that our ideal of a judge, and I do think David Souter was one of those for 19 years who came closest to embodying this ideal. I think our ideal of the judge is someone who approaches cases, whether at the trial level or at the appellate level, capable of dispensing justice to rich and poor, to the have-nots as well as the haves, to the different constituents that make up our nation. And we have plenty of justices who care deeply about the poor. Where they differ, of course, is whether laws they are construing can be construed, ought to be construed in particular cases, hard cases, because those are the ones that reach the court, to favor a particular group, a particular class. So I share the caller's bottom line concern that we want justices, and this goes back to President Obama's word, empathy, I believe. But we don't want folks who favor one side of the pendulum so strongly that he or she is incapable of deciding cases that favor those on the other side.
Thank you, Jim, so much for your call. Again, from the Times Sunday's issue, former students, I quote here, and colleagues describe Mr. Obama as a minimalist and also as a structuralist. Do you agree, and what does that mean?
Well, I can't, having not sat in Professor Obama's classes, I cannot take issue with his students. I think the structuralist point is an important one because, as I view it, it is it goes to somebody who respects the principal divisions and allocations of power in our Constitution, the federal-state balance, that is to say the vertical balance, the horizontal balance at the national level among courts, the executive branch, the president, and Congress, and a host of other divisions and allocations of power in our system, respects the fundamental structure of our nation, which is a federalist system, which has states and the national government working on both of us, and at the national level has Congress, the president, and courts, each with respective but overlapping functions. And that's part of what I mean when I say, to use words like leftists, as the first caller did, to describe President Obama's ultimate nominee, or nominees, I think might be a little bit too glib, too simple. It would not surprise me if such a person did not fit neatly into such a characterization.
Suggestion nominees?
I'm going to pass on that one. I gave a final exam last semester to my students in a constitutional law class in which one of the questions I posed to them was I posited a particular Supreme Court nominee and asked them to pose one particular equal protection question to that nominee, explain why. And I chose a person who is on the longer list. No, I have no inside poop. I have no inside knowledge.
on the question of whether it is likely that a woman will be suggested, more commentators seem to say yes than no. I suspect President Obama will get at least two appointments if he's a one-term president, and at least three if he's a two-term president. So we'll see. But I'm not going to toss out a name. Although I've got a long shot candidate.
Oh, come on! You got to tell us who it is.
No. I got a long shot candidate.
Can you tell us in private, and then we'll see if you were right.
Yeah, but you're a reporter, Kathleen, and there is no such thing as privacy with a reporter. You know that.
I was just trying to get you to talk. All right, thank you. Thanks very much, Professor Rofus.
I appreciate it, Kathleen.
Professor Peter Rofus, Professor of Law, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Director of Part-Time Legal Education at Marquette University. And also, he has served as an advisor to Senator Herb Kohl and the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. Senate on the nominees of David Souter, Clarence Thomas, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, and John Roberts to the Supreme Court. We're staying on the same subject, just changing guests for you and welcoming more phone calls. The number is, there's one line open. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We're getting the next guest on the line right now. Professor Lee Epstein is going to be joining us. He is the Henry Wade Rogers Professor at Northwestern University and a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Academy of Political and Social Science. He has some interesting recent projects, Circuit Effects, one of them, which argues that the benefits of drawing Supreme Court justices from the circuits are overstated and the costs are understated. He also has written about why strong swings emerge on the court, and we're talking with Lee Epstein. She'll be joining us in just one moment, professor, as I said, at Northwestern University. And welcome in phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For you to join our conversation, and we'll see if she's with us. Professor Epstein, are you there?
Good morning.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Yeah, you were quoted in the Times, I can't remember what day, but you said this, which I think is an interesting place to start. Diversity of inputs makes for stronger outputs. Diversity has become a term for race and gender, but it also applies to career experience and background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, amplify on that. That's an interesting statement.
You know, it's actually an idea that, at least for the Supreme Court, it really traces back to an unlikely source, William Rehnquist.
Really?
Yeah. In one of his last State of the Judiciary addresses before, I think it was might maybe been 2004 State of the Judiciary address, he talked about a concern that the federal courts were becoming too professionalized, that they were just full of judges. So Court of Appeals judges had come from the district courts, and U.S. Supreme Court judges, justices, were coming from the courts of appeals. And he was very concerned about that trend.
So you would have suggestion for the president to go outside here to look at somebody who hasn't perhaps been traditionally represented on the court?
Well, actually, if you go back throughout the history of the court did come from a diverse sort of strains within the legal field. So you had people coming to the court straight from private practice. Lewis Powell is probably the most recent example. You had people coming from the state courts, from the government, senators. We had governors. So we had diverse courts throughout history. This, in terms of career background, is probably the most homogeneous. It's the first time in American history we've had 9 justices, all of whom came from the appellate courts.
Oh, that's interesting. And is it because, as somebody has suggested, that presidents have turned to candidates who have a strong paper trail so they can get a better idea of how they're going to vote?
You know, it's really interesting. That seems to be the modern-day story, but if you go back, this idea of appointing federal judges started with the Eisenhower administration. Eisenhower had been lobbied by Southern members of Congress after Brown versus the Board of Education. They wanted Eisenhower to appoint federal judges who they thought would follow the law and not make the law. And they were really then talking about people like Earl Warren, who was governor of California, Hugo Black, who had been senator, and Felix Frankfurter, who had come from Harvard Law School. The senators wanted judges who would follow precedent, and Eisenhower proceeded to appoint federal judges. So it stems from a very different source, but I think today people say, well, you know, you can look at the federal judges' opinions and get some sense of how they'll be on the Supreme Court.
Do you think, Professor Epstein, it looks as though, and maybe our first guest didn't like the terms conservative and liberal, but mm-hmm. when we think about the more liberal members of the court, mm-hmm. that those will be the ones that President Obama will have a chance to replace, and so we're going to keep having this 5-4, 5-4, 5-4?
Well, who knows who he's going to get a chance
that's
to
true.
Replace? Justices may come from the right side of the court. Vacancies may come from the right side of the court, too. But putting that question aside, look, I think that when you add new justices to the court, you change the court. It's a small group. So think about any small group you know of nine people. You take one out, put another person in, it can change the mix a little bit. We do have a very strong swing justice in Anthony Kennedy. He can go to the right, he can go to the left, and who knows what kind of influence a new justice will have on him. So I do think this talk that a new justice isn't going to change much because it's coming from one side of the court, I don't know how much I buy that.
And your assessment of David Souter's time on the court?
Mm-hmm. Look, I think what Souter did, he came on the court and he seemed like he was going to be pretty conservative. If David Souter had stayed the way he was his first two terms on the court, we would be talking about somebody reasonably moderately conservative, about like Anthony Kennedy, maybe to his right. But Souter moved considerably to the left during his time, and what he did, I think, was provide a crucial player in upholding Roe versus Wade, upholding affirmative action. So some of the big kind of liberal decisions on the court, he was part of that coalition.
We have a lot of people who would like to speak with you. We're talking about the Supreme Court, the David Souter's leaving the court, and where President Obama might be going with this and where he should be going with this. And let's welcome more calls. Bruce is next from Baraboo. Thanks for waiting, Bruce. Hi.
Good morning. Could the professor refresh our memories on an eminent domain case? I think it was with a pharmaceutical company.
No.
When was this? I don't remember this, Bruce.
Oh, there were protests and his house got egged.
Oh, for Souter?
Oh, you're talking about the Kelo case.
Oh.
Yeah. There was a takings clause case that was quite controversial. Yeah,
some time ago was this?
Some years ago, yes.
Okay. Anything else, Bruce?
I just kind of fuzzy on it. I thought maybe I could get cleared up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks very much for the call. Michael is next from Janesville. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Great
sure.
show. I just want to mention that it's coming from the right when they're complaining that Obama has put our government so far more to the left than any other president. Obviously, this country's political climate has swung to the left because we elected a black man. And secondly, they forget about the fact that Reagan stacked the U.S. Supreme Court when he got in. Daddy Bush did. Baby Bush tried. That's pretty much the privilege of the president.
I do think it's an important point. I mean, people think about the nomination process for Supreme Court justices as becoming quite ideological and political. But in fact, you go back to the earliest days in American history, and it was quite political. John Adams, go back to George Washington, who wanted supporters of the Constitution on the court. John Adams, the second president, tried to pack the courts with good Federalists. So this is not what we're seeing today is certainly not new.
And thanks for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. Justice David Souter decided that he was going to retire last week, and we're looking at his time on the Supreme Court and where the president may be going with this and the importance of this election, et cetera. So join us. No emails yet today. Give us an email. Talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, or 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we will be talking about women and heart health. Two other women who have survived heart attacks will be joining me, and we'll also have a cardiologist with us to talk about how to keep your heart healthy, what the signs are for women experiencing cardiovascular disease, and also what treatments are. So all of that is coming up the second hour of our program today. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number, because the president is from, well, the Midwest, also from Hawaii, but has a strong Chicago base. You said something interesting in the Times about how the court really has treated lower court decisions from the Northeast with more deference. There seems to be an Eastern Northern bias on the court, which is interesting. How about somebody from Chicago as a replacement? Huh?
Why not?
Yeah, why not?
Why not? No, I mean, it's an interesting court in lots of ways, and one of the ways is it's a fairly homogeneous court. It's a court that pretty much all of the sitting justices served as circuit court judges, and the vast majority are from the Northeast. We do, of course, have Justice Stevens, a Northwestern alum, I'll add, who is from the Chicago area, and we have Justice Kennedy from California. I think Justice Breyer was born in California, but has spent most of his life in the Northeast, and so it's a fairly homogeneous court geographically, and throughout history, of course, that would have been unacceptable. At one time, geographical diversity was extremely important, but no longer. And I think many of the candidates, at least the conventional wisdom candidates, are also from the North Northeast area.
Let's go to George from Oshkosh, our next caller. Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, I read a long time ago that the number of judges can be increased or decreased. So, first question, what do you need to increase the number of judges? And second question, why doesn't Obama increase the number of judges?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Let's just stay on the U.S. Supreme Court. The number of the U.S. Supreme Court justices did fluctuate through the 1800s, and in fact, we got up to 10 at one point. The number's been set at 9 since the late 1800s, and of course, Roosevelt famously tried to pack the court, try to add new justices to the court and increase the size, and that plan didn't go anywhere, and I think presidents are a little gun-shy since then about suggesting increases in the size of the court.
But what does it take to increase it?
It would take congressional legislation. Congress gets to set the size of the Supreme Court, so it would take a law passed by Congress increasing the size.
Okay, so just with the 60 senators would be enough to increase?
Well, that's the interesting thing. You know, no, these are great questions.
Right.
You would have thought during the Roosevelt years, when Roosevelt was president, he had been elected by enormous margins. He controlled, 75-80% of Congress, and yet this plan was extremely unpopular to increase the size of the court. People have speculated on why it was unpopular, and it did not get passed. And so the history lesson there, what people say about it, is even a wildly popular president with a big majorities in Congress couldn't get a court packing bill through. And not many have raised the issue since.
Thank you, George.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for your call. We go to Dave from St. Francis. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
I really like your show, and your guest today is very good. And I was very happy with both Souter and you were mentioning Kennedy. I like their kind of unpredictable responses to a lot of legal questions. And I guess my question, though, as far as a replacement, I would hope that they could possibly get somebody that would put a little more teeth into the Freedom of Information Act and a little more for disclosure of a lot of things that have been hidden by our government. And if your guest had a suggestion as if there's a justice that could possibly be influential in bringing some of that to light.
You know, I really, off the top of my head, don't have a good answer for you. I think on lots of issues, it's hard to predict how particular people might behave. I think it's, we were talking earlier about federal courts of appeals judges, and some people have suggested it's, you know, presidents have gone with federal court of appeals judges because they have some record. You know, I'm not so sure how telling some of those records are of how a judge will behave when he or she becomes a justice on the Supreme Court. I think there's lots of incentives for federal appellate court judges who want to get on the Supreme Court to mask their views a little bit, to look like more attractive candidates. So I think it's very hard to tell in a number of areas of the law how anyone, once they get to the Supreme Court, is going to decide cases.
Can you imagine Professor Epstein leaving the court after 19 years? It's an incredibly important position in America. The guy loves American history. He knows he's making a significant contribution. And instead, he's going home to read history. He's going to eat some more apples and go sailing.
You know, I think Linda Greenhouse had a very interesting article about David Souter in the Sunday Times. And, you know, no doubt one of the points is, one of the takeaways for me is, look, you know, he's done his job and he's ready to go home. He's done his service. And there was a time in American history when justices did leave and didn't stay on forever and ever and ever. And there's been complaints about Supreme Court justices staying on the court for too long. Look at William Rehnquist, stayed on really until he died. So, you know, maybe Souter is setting trying to set a new norm.
Hmm. What do you think? Should there be a limit?
You know, I'm sympathetic to some of the proposals to have a sort of an 18-year or 20-year term limit on the justices. I think we were getting to the point where there wasn't the frequent enough turnover on the court throughout history. I think I think on average, presidents in a 4-year term got to appoint 2 justices, but we were getting close to 1 justice during a 4-year term. Jimmy Carter had no appointments during his 4-year term. And I tend to think that some turnover on the court periodically is a good thing. Now, of course, we're starting to see some turnover.
Right.
It's possible that President Obama will have another 2-3 appointments.
Thank you, Dave, very much for your call. Let's go to John from Kenosha next. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I have a two-part question that goes back to Bush v. Gore.
Yeah.
And the one part relates to Justice Souter's role in that, and I believe almost resignation. And the other part goes to what I call judicial activism on the right. In other words, the conservative justices lined up and were basically engaging in judicial activism and not living with originalism by intervening and taking the Florida Supreme Court out of it. And I'll stop at that and then hear from the professor.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
Well, I think, you know, the number of articles and books and so on that have been written by Bush versus Gore could fill offices. There's been so much commentary on the case, and I think it's hard to ignore the fact that the decisions in those cases, probably if the U.S. Supreme Court and the Florida courts were kind of partisan political decisions with judges and justices casting their votes in the cases for the candidates they liked. The always the hypothetical is what if Bush had been Gore and Gore had been Bush? Would we have seen the same outcome? It's hard to know what else to add to the huge discussion that's already taken place over that case. I think the term you mentioned the term activism, and these are terms that are thrown around: judicial activism and judicial restraint. In a lot of the use of those terms, I think activism ends up standing for judges and justices we don't like. We don't like them. They're activists. That kind of language. It is true, I think, though, that especially the Rehnquist court was a very active court in the sense of overturning federal laws. So we did see activism on the right, as you put it, during the Rehnquist court years, if by activism you mean overturning federal laws.
I hadn't thought about Bush v. Gore in a while, and
yeah.
When I think about it again, it was an extraordinary time, wasn't it?
It really was.
It was an extraordinary
time.
I
think that most of us, at least I won't use the term most of us, but I think many people in the academy were just stunned that the court even took the case.
Yes. Right.
I think we were just really surprised that it took it. And then, of course, the momentous decision. What's very interesting about Bush versus Gore, I think, though, is many people wanted the Supreme Court to decide the case. They had enough faith in the court, and they wanted those nine justices to settle the dispute.
Right. Let's go to Jim from River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Well, it's funny that we got into Bush v. Gore.
Yeah,
yeah, it is.
It's interesting. When Sandra Day O'Connor announced her retirement from the court, I thought there would be a lot of discussion about Bush versus Gore, and there really wasn't, and the sort of the crucial role she played in that.
I had kind of a two-part thing. The first, I had heard some reports that, in fact, Justice Souter would have liked to have departed the court earlier because he was disgusted by that decision, but hung around hoping that, knowing there'd be a different administration after President Bush's second term, and that then he might be more amenable to leaving. Then the other question I had briefly was, we talked about Judge Souter, and I'm wondering what you thought of him in comparison to, say, Judge Thomas, as far as being an independent thinker. I kind of have the impression that Justice Thomas looks to Justice Scalia for kind of helping him to make his decisions.
It's very interesting. I think the conventional view about Justice Thomas was just that he very much took his cues from Justice Scalia. But there's an interesting book that Jan Crawford Greenberg wrote, I think it was last year or the year before, on the Supreme Court, where she seems to suggest, Jan Crawford Greenberg covered the Supreme Court for the Chicago Tribune, and I think she's with one of the networks now. She's a reporter. And she, I think, really intimates in that book that that Justice Thomas, in fact, has had a big effect on Scalia, that the influence has gone the other way around.
Hmm.
And that's a little hard to tell because they do vote together quite often. So it's a little hard to tell where the influence arrow is pointing, I think. Justice Thomas certainly has his views, and he's been relatively consistent, I think, in at least in his votes on the court since he's arrived.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. We have time for one more call, 1 minute left. Anne from Waukesha, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention, one of the things that really stands out to me in an administration of many poor decisions and revelations of ignorance was Bush's nomination of Harriet Myers.
Mm-hmm.
That was shocking to me that he had no idea. It seemed to reveal he had no idea what the Supreme Court was. after so many years as president. And I'm just wondering if your guest, you know, had that same reaction. I could not believe that. And it sort of just doesn't get mentioned anymore, but that was truly shocking.
You know, I think if on paper, Harriet Myers was not, I would not call it, you know, just a crazy appointment. On paper, in some ways, she looked a lot like Lewis Powell, who many people admire, who was coming to the court from private practice, a bar association president. Harriet Myers, one of the first female law partners in Dallas. What turned out to be, I think, a couple of things. One is the immediate cronyism charge, which can be quite deadly. And then I think second, the right, the right, the conservatives really helped to torpedo that appointment.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Thank you so much. You were wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good morning.
Thanks. You too. Professor Lee Epstein, Henry Wade Rogers, professor at Northwestern. And we also thank Professor Peter Rofus, professor of law, associate dean for academic affairs at Marquette University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll return following the news here on the Ideas Network.